They decided not to execute us.
The soldiers beat us, but we actually had received privileged treatment. We were still alive. They kept on firing into the Timorese. We were able to get onto a passing civilian truck, went into hiding, but the Timorese who had been with us there on the cemetery road, most of them were dead.
Inside the cemetery walls, Max Stahl, a filmmaker on assignment with Yorkshire TV, had had his video camera running.
The soldiers began at that point to encircle the entire cemetery. I saw soldiers as they gradually moved towards the middle, picking out people who were wounded or taking refuge between the tombstones. And when they got to them, they beat them and assembled them in the back of the cemetery. People were stripped to their waist. They had their thumbs tied behind their backs. And they were made to look at the ground. And if they looked up, they were immediately beaten, usually with a rifle butt.
Max Stahl was filming near a crypt in the middle of the cemetery. Some of the wounded and those too scared to run were huddled inside praying. As Stahl filmed, he buried his video cassettes in a fresh grave. Then he was arrested by the troops.
Whilst I was being interrogated, I observed these trucks driving by with more people in them. These people were clearly in a kind of paralysis of fear. They were not able to move, some of them, at least in the cemetery, and indeed even in the trucks when I saw them going by, were barely breathing. When people are that terrified, it's quite often difficult to tell if they're dead or alive.
After 9 hours in custody, Stahl went back to the cemetery under cover of night, dug up his video cassettes, and had them smuggled out of the country. Alan Nairn and I had managed to leave East Timor a few hours after the massacre. From a hospital on Guam, we reported what had happened to dozens of newspapers, radio, and television outlets around the world.
From Washington, this is the Pacifica Report for Tuesday, November 12, 1991. A massacre in East Timor. Among those injured were two journalists, including the news editor of Pacifica Station WBAI in New York.
They beat me and dragged me over and started slamming me with rifle butts and kicks and punches. And then Alan jumped on top of me, and they beat him very badly. But that was the least of what they did. They opened fire on the people, and these were truly...
This is CBC Radio.
The massacre of 100 unarmed Timorese by the Indonesian military...
Imagine the first
photographs of a bloody massacre during a fight for freedom.
Is the CBS Evening News.
In the face of the massacre story, even Suharto's longtime allies were compelled to condemn the killings and came under public pressure to cut back their aid to Indonesia. In Australia, large crowds marched on the capital and surrounded Indonesia's local consulates. The European Parliament voted for sanctions against Indonesia, and the European community later canceled the scheduled trade pact. There were even open protests inside Indonesia, where student demonstrators were beaten and arrested. Back in the United States, the Bush administration continued to ship weapons to Indonesia.
That's an excerpt of Massacre, the Story of East Timor, the documentary I produced with journalist Alan Nairn. East Timor, or Timor-Leste, would vote for its freedom in a UN referendum in 1999 and become an independent nation in 2002, one of the newest nations in the world. The video from inside the cemetery was filmed by Max Stahl, the award-winning filmmaker who died several weeks ago at the age of 66. To see the whole thing, go to Democracy Now! .org. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
black liberation possible in the United States? Not as the United States is currently configured. These are problems that we can't vote our way in or out of. These are not problems that are on the ballot. We don't get to vote on the massive redistribution of wealth and resources in this country. It really requires a different society where there's the democratic input of all of us about what our society should be and what it should look like. That can't happen in the way that this country exists now. To that extent, what I'm talking about is really a revolutionary transformation of the United States.
That's Kianga Yamata Taylor, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Kianga Yamata Taylor on black liberation. The widespread protests in the wake of the murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor marked a new chapter in the struggle for black liberation. What would constitute black liberation? Kianga Yamata Taylor says it's about self-determination. Can we make decisions free of economic coercion? Can we make decisions that are truly free? That, to me, is what liberation would be. She continues, I know that it's not something that black people can achieve alone. Black liberation is bound up with human liberation. On a purely mathematical basis, black people drift between 13% and 14% of the population. We can't get free alone. So this is also about really trying to examine the connections between the subjugation of black people and how that relates to a wider web of subjugation of other people. And that includes white people, too. Our guest today is Kianga Yamata Taylor. She writes and speaks on black politics, social movements, and racial inequality. She's a professor of African American studies at Princeton. Her articles appear in The New Yorker, The Nation, The Guardian, and Jacobin. She's the author of Race for Profit, How We Get Free, and the award-winning From Hashtag Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. Kianga Yamata Taylor was in Philadelphia in mid-July. The interviewer was Michelle Alexander, Ohio State University professor and author of the bestseller The New Jim Crow. She poses the first question.
One of the themes that's most striking in your book is that it's impossible to understand black politics and activism in America today, particularly with respect to the Obama era, without understanding the nature of the class divide that exists within black communities. You know, in mainstream discourse, particularly within the mainstream media, when class is discussed explicitly, it's usually in the context of explaining or defending the angry white men who voted for Trump or the challenges the Democratic Party has faced in trying to appeal to less educated working class whites. But a key insight in your book is that class divisions are driving race politics. We're driving those protests to a large degree. And you write that black economic elites have a vested interest in the notion of colorblindness and the myth that the US is basically a meritocracy and the notion that the election of Barack Obama shows that we have overcome or are overcoming. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about the role of class in black politics and activism and how the gap between the rich and poor is even more pronounced among blacks than whites and why that matters in thinking about protest and politics then and today.
Yeah, absolutely. And the events in Ferguson, I mean, there are many events that crystallize this, but when you think about Ferguson and the way that, for example, the Congressional Black Caucus mobilized itself to go to Ferguson, and their main objective was voter registration, right? That this is, we got to get people registered and we have to vote, and that's the most important thing. And, you know, people try to characterize the clash and the conflict between young activists who were on the street and, you know, they booed Jesse Jackson when he spoke. There was sort of, you know, deep hostilities between these young activists and Al Sharpton. And, you know, people try to convey that as a kind of generational split. And clearly there, you know, there was some of that where younger people are more willing to take risks in their protest. Older people who have suffered all sorts of political defeats may draw more conservative conclusions about what we need to do in order to advance this particular cause. But another feature of it was a kind of class division between those who had some problems with governance and some problems with the status quo, but for the most part had reconciled and found ways to make the status quo work for them. And then a majority of poor and working class Black people for whom the status quo was quite deadly. And Mike Brown was certainly a symbol of that. And then when you get to Baltimore, I think there is a much more hard and ingrained division that we see all over the country now, whether it is in Washington, D.C., Chicago, New Orleans. I mean, there are many places that have Black elected leaderships, that have Black mayors, for whom beyond the issue of race, they really have very little in common with the majority Black population of the majority of Black people who are in their cities. And so in a place like Baltimore, where conditions had deteriorated in part because you had approach to governing that was really interested in attracting business with low promises of low taxes, of cutting budgets for social services that Black people who were disproportionately living in poverty were reliant upon. And this is a governing model that is not just popular in Baltimore, it's popular across the United States, that really put young Black working class people at odds with a Black political leadership and a Black elite in that city. And I think that those tensions were amplified during the Obama administration. And for me, it is one of the differences that exist when you have the reemergence of Black Lives Matter last summer, where then you have all of these Black officials who are paraded around as representatives of Black America and who are able to maintain that because Trump is racist and makes racist, disparaging comments about Black elected officials. Elijah Cummings, who was a congressional representative for Baltimore, was in a dispute with Trump. And Trump went on to Twitter and described Baltimore as a rat-infested place that no human being would want to live in. I mean, it's just, there's no codes, there's no innuendo. It's just full-throated racism. And so it changes the dynamic then of the tensions that were exposed and on the surface during the Obama administration get buried under this attack in defense of racist attacks that call for a kind of racial solidarity. Those class tensions become muted once again.
Yeah, let's move forward to 2020 or, you know, to the Trump administration. Does the Trump experience change your view or thinking at all? Is it better or worse in your view to have a deeply flawed president like Obama, who invited activists into the White House and gave them a seat at the table, but who offered little in terms of structural change, or a racist wannabe dictator like Trump? You know, what is the difference between having someone who professes to care about racial justice and who does, and someone who makes plain he doesn't give a damn?
So I think that instead of thinking about it as better or worse, that it's, to me, it's better to look at the relationship between the two, how one helped to create the atmosphere of the other. And so what I mean by that is, I think that part of the reason why Hillary Clinton had a low Black turnout relative to other years, I mean, in 2016, it was the lowest Black turnout for a presidential election in 20 years. And so we can't divorce that from those raised and then dashed expectations that came with the Obama administration and the failure for the federal government to assert itself in any kind of meaningful way, at least meaningful to the tens of thousands of young Black people who saw themselves aligned with the movement, is probably a big reason for that. But it's not the only reason for that. I think also when you combine that kind of neglect of the most pertinent kind of immediate social issue with then 8 years of economic stagnation or just standing still, while you see, you know, the big recoveries for Wall Street, you see the big recoveries for the banks. You know, I think Obama admitted himself that 95% of the recovery from the 2008 financial crisis went to the top 1-2% of the country, that also contributed to an atmosphere where people did not feel compelled to come out and vote, as well as the fact that there was a sense that Clinton as the candidate was a scenario that people had already seen before, had already experienced before, and weren't particularly compelled about that either. And so I think that those are part of a kind of what I would describe as a set of structural explanations that contribute to the Trump phenomenon that make it difficult to kind of separate out what happened during the Obama years from what then ends up with Trump. Now, to be sure, the Trump presidency was disastrous on many different levels. I mean, Trump ran in part on race baiting Black Lives Matter, on putting Black Lives Matter in the crosshairs, on, you know, aligning himself with police, on egging on police brutality. And so that created, you know, an atmosphere of fear and intimidation for BLM activists and for people who dare to speak out about racism in connection to his administration. I know that 6 months into his administration, I gave a 20-minute talk. I spent 19 seconds talking about Trump as a racist, sexist megalomaniac, something that if you said now, it's like Tuesday. And I was inundated with death threats, and Fox News played the clip over and over and over again on a holiday weekend. I mean, this was the kind of hothouse atmosphere of violence and intimidation, in addition to then the kind of, you know, theft from the bottom, given away to the top, the criminal incompetence around the handling of the pandemic that all then exploded last summer. And so I think that there are important differences when you have a president, as you pointed out, who's willing to open up the doors, to put some activists on a police commission, to really engage in this, what I would call the theater of reform that looks very busy, that looks very concerned, with very little actually happening that is changing anything. That's different from the kind of rank hostility, from the threats to use the military to put down political protests. And yet, you know, I think that in many ways the movement has grown and developed in sophisticated ways coming out of last summer, both in terms of building networks of solidarity, of getting beyond the kind of reforms that were at the heart of the movement in 2014 and 15, which was focused on body cameras and commission studies to defund the police, which people in the Democratic Party establishment mock and talk about as horrible, but which has actually opened up a very important discussion in this country about how police are funded versus other public services, whether that is the best way to deal with issues of violence in communities. And so, you know, it's not one period versus the other. It's how these things have built and developed over really probably the last 8 or 9 years.
So what would you say are the primary lessons that have been learned from experience during the Obama and Trump years? You know, it's, I see it as no small irony that after the last largest racial justice protests in world history against police violence, progressives elected as president a white man who is a champion of the 90s crime bills and legislation and contributed massive amounts of funding to police and prisons and the rise of mass incarceration, and that we also elected as vice president a black woman of Jamaican and Indian descent who was a career prosecutor before being elected to the Senate and then vice president. And there's also been the surge of black electoral victories in New York State and elsewhere, you know, which is being heralded as great progress. And I wonder kind of what do you make of this moment in which black people are achieving significant electoral gains? And what are the lessons do you think that have been learned and incorporated into movement work and activism? You know, decades ago, MLK warned that black people would be elected to high places in large numbers, but that didn't necessarily mean that meaningful change would occur. What's your assessment of the growth that has or hasn't taken place in our movements in relationship to representational politics, electoral politics?
One thing I think is interesting about Biden and Kamala Harris is, in spite of themselves and despite their records, they have been forced to at least articulate completely different politics, different, certainly different from the platforms that they ran on. And I think that is a testament to the power of social movements. There are certainly, there are limits to that, but I do think that is worth acknowledging. I mean, you know, Joe Biden ran on not changing anything and just, you know, maintaining the status quo. And, you know, that's not left-wing rhetoric. I mean, that's what he ran on, that we're not going to make big changes here. We're just going to stop the craziness of the Trump administration. And, you know, Kamala Harris was out very early in the Democratic Party primaries because she had no traction, because no one believed anything that she had to say. I mean, she just seemed like fairly typical, what would you like for me to say? And that is what my campaign focus will be. And the candidate that many people wanted and that had great momentum until the end was Bernie Sanders. And then, you know, I think that Sanders ran into the inadequacies of his own campaign over 2016 and 2020 in terms of really being able to, his rhetoric changed significantly, but you need bases, you need inroads, you need much more of a stable presence. Combined with the onset of a pandemic, people forget that this was all unfolding at the same time, and the question lingering in the back was, do we really want to entrust this to an inexperienced person when we already have that in the White House who seems to be fumbling this issue of the pandemic already? I think from where those Joe Biden and Kamala Harris began as on the most conservative end of the pool of Democratic Party candidates to where they ended up rhetorically, because I don't believe that some of the programs and spending that have been championed are representative of what Joe Biden, for example, who was a deficit hawk throughout the 1980s, believes for governing. But I think that they recognize an extreme problem, which is that if you don't engage the base in a serious way with a clear program around massive spending in the aftermath of the worst set of crises in American history, then not only will people not come out and vote, but it will really be the end of the Democratic Party. Like, people are not going to come out and vote for nothing when you have riots in the street, when you have the largest protest movement in American history. And so they started making promises and they've started spending. The problem now, of course, is that this is all defensive spending. None of this is permanent. There haven't been permanent programs that have been created out of this. So all of the talk about, you know, the U.S. government is back, big government is back, is very premature. I think for the movement, in terms of some of the lessons that I've thought about and written about, you know, one of the things I wrote about in 2016 that I still think has not been really addressed in Black Lives Matter is really the lack of organization. I mean, there are lots of little organizations, but the lack of bigger coalitions and organizations that create the space for democratic debate and input about what the movement is, where it's going, where it wants to go, but even more importantly, what are our different kinds of visions for how to do that? And there are different visions, and all movements produce multiple ideas about what should be done and how to do it. And in this movement, those multiple ideas exist, but there have rarely been spaces where people can engage each other outside of social media or outside of tightly curated spaces that are created by some conveners, but only, you know, for the sake of kind of reinforcing the ideas that they began with, not to actually engage in any kind of meaningful democratic debate. And so I still believe that this is a movement that yearns for democracy, that yearns for political accountability. People talk about the movement being leaderless, and it sounds good, but there are always leaders. The question is not, are there leaders? The question is, who are those leaders accountable to? And those are political issues that have been, I think, have gone unresolved, and that I think represent the lack of engagement on those issues represents a problem, because it means that there's no place to discuss, debate, ways to pressure this administration for more than emergency spending, more than emergency funding, but fundamental programs, a fundamentally different approach to dealing with these issues, whatever they may be, jobs, pandemic, policing. And we don't have that. And so what I've written before is the way that the right has taken over the Republican Party. And so they have a vessel to shape public opinion about what they think. I mean, you can see how quickly you go from the nonsensical idiocy about critical race theory to that's all they talk about. That is an effective use of organization. We don't have that on our side.
Well, some would argue that, you know, creating a new political party would be the vehicle for creating some base for organization and structure and potentially funding. But there's, you know, myriad challenges in trying to go from where we are to launching a new, although, you know, the Working Families Party and others are trying to wrestle with those questions and find paths forward in that direction. Although, you know, that party or the Green Party are not explicitly focused on Black issues you know, to varying degrees have racial justice as a focus. But I also assume that when you talk about the need for greater organization, you aren't talking about a need for nonprofit organizations that are funded by foundations that themselves have been kind of very much complicit in various ways with the supporting of kind of billionaire philanthropy solutions to the problems of racial capitalism. And so I'm curious, like, what you envision when you talk about the need for greater organization. What would that look like in your mind, ideally, if it's not new political party, and if it's not the kind of organizations that, you know, have been funded quite well as of late, right, by the major foundations, what does it look like in your mind?
I think about it on two different kinds of levels. One is literally coalitions. So we have existing organizations in Black Lives Matter. Is there a way for groups of those organizations to be able to meet together, to talk about their experiences together, to be able to generalize from their experiences from South Bend, Indiana, to Atlanta, Georgia, to LA, to Dallas, Texas? What can we learn from our different experiences? And then to have these questions out about, what is this movement? What do we think the movement should be? What are the things that we should be fighting for? What are the disputes around that? What are the disagreements around that? Such as, do we support as a demand defunding the police? Does that mean that you need to be a prison abolitionist to do that? What do we think of this? You know, these people have really different ideas and good ideas and bad ideas. And there's just very little political comradely conversation about those things, where then we can come to some mutual decisions or discuss, you know, determinations about what that means. Even if the determination is, we probably can't work together on this particular issue, maybe we can work together on something else. So that's one kind of coalition-like structure that doesn't need C3 status or funding, that needs the capacity of people to be able to get together and to make some decisions about decision making, about how do we include in a democratic way the voices and perspectives of the many people who contribute to this movement. And then another scale is one of political party. I think that the long reach of the foundations and funders is real. I think that that doesn't mean that we have to abandon that source of money, because in one sense, we can't bake sale our way into the resources that are necessary to have the kinds of reach that we need to be effective. But it does mean that structurally, we can create ways to deal with the influence of funders and philanthropy. And that is really where leaning in on democracy is important, where we don't have situations where we have this professionalization of activism, where the staffers or the people who are drawing an income from this work are the ones who make the sole determinations, or the ones who are the most influential, making the ultimate decisions, but that we create within our structures democratic oversight, that we get back to voting on things, that we get to, you know, have discussions and make collective decisions about things. I don't think that those are that's utopian or that is impossible, but it must be intentional. It can't just happen because, you know, someone thinks that it's a good idea. It has to be woven into our a practice of organizing. And I think the party question is one that we can't avoid any longer. I mean, people constantly avoid this question, and every election is too consequential to lose, right? The Democrats rely on this, that the Republicans are the Neanderthals at the gates, and it means that we can't lose, so we have to close ranks around whatever Democrat is put in front of us. And that is a dynamic that we've been locked in. And I think part of the reason that we will stay locked in it is if we continue to be dispersed, diffuse, no places to argue and debate these political questions about what our movement is and how we can move from reactive protest mass protests, as important as they are, to really something different that challenges the political structures, that actually seeks to create an alternative.
You're listening to Kianga Yamata Taylor on Black Liberation. This is independent alternative radio. You can get CDs of this program and Kianga Yamata Taylor's book from hashtag Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation by just calling us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977, or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. We're offering printed transcripts, PDFs, or MP3s of this program at no charge. Just give us a call at 1-800-444-1977.
It strikes me that one of the many things that would need to be explored, discussed, debated, is the extent to which capitalism becomes central to the work of anti-racist activists, organizers, movement builders. And, you know, one of the great strengths and contributions of your book is that it doesn't shy away from that question and addressing the role of capitalism in creating and maintaining racial inequality. And at one point in the book, you suggest that, you know, we ask ourselves, can conditions created by institutional racism ever be transformed within the capitalist order? And I wonder how you might respond to, you know, activists or perhaps people who are new to the movement, who think that challenging capitalism is too tall an order, and that kind of striving for racial equity within the system is a big enough ring to reach for, that they don't necessarily even know what it means to challenge capitalism or what that would even look like. How would you respond to someone who's kind of wondering, you know, why is it really necessary for us to challenge the capitalist order in order to undo institutional racism?
I think part of that is understanding what structural racism means. And so much of the discussion, especially in the last year with the popularity of, you know, books like White Fragility. Robin DiAngelo, who wrote White Fragility, has a new book out that is a critique of what she describes as nice racism, racism from progressive people. And whatever you think about that, none of these are actually getting to what structural capitalism means. And so for me, that means centrally looking at the way that capitalism creates what Marxists sometimes refer to as false scarcity. And what is false scarcity? It means, you know, we have these hand-wringing discussions about there's not enough affordable housing. Well, how can there not be enough affordable housing? This is the richest country in the history of humanity. This is a country that spends almost $1 trillion a year on its defense budget. Of course, there's enough resources to create enough sound, quality, safe and sound housing for every single person in this country, but there's not enough. And so it's the scarcity of the things that we need, from jobs to education to housing to healthcare, that helps to create an atmosphere where ordinary people must compete with each other in order to secure these things. And in that atmosphere of competition, the notion of undeserving people, of people who should have access to these things versus people who shouldn't have access to these things, is really part of a fertile environment where racism can take hold. So that's one part of it. The other part of it is much more crass, which is the way that racism is profitable, right? When Newsday does, you know, has a big, it's a daily in Long Island, has this big expose. They've done a 3-year undercover story about racism among realtors. So realtors who are steering Black people to one section of Long Island, steering Latinos to another section, steering white people to another section. Are they just doing this because they haven't been to Robin DiAngelo's workshop on, you know, racism? Or is there something greater than the individual attitudes and outlooks of the people involved, which, by the way, include not just white real estate agents, but Black real estate agents and South Asian real estate agents and Latino real estate agents as well? Well, the preservation of the housing market as it stands means that, you know, that you steer people to the white people, to the white neighborhood, and exclusive white housing remains extremely expensive, that Black people introduced into white neighborhoods brings the value of that property down, which has a cascading effect in the housing economy. And so when Wells Fargo refers to Black people in Baltimore as mud people, as loans given to Black people as ghetto loans, like, this is all part of a political economy built on racism that is profitable. And so these are the structural barriers to the liberal idea of just racial equality. This is why it's so hard, not because we haven't workshopped out all of the tensions, that not enough people know the history. Of course, that would help. It would help that if, you know, every time something happens in this country, there's not like some revelation that, oh, there's a long history and blah, blah, blah. You know, historical knowledge would help, which is why I think the Juneteenth holiday is actually an important milestone. But ignorance alone is not why we continue to see iterations of the same problem for 156 years since slavery ended. It is because it is to the benefit of some people, like some people greatly benefit. We can look at, you know, white median income in this country is $70,000. For Black people, it's $53,000. Okay, so that's some benefit. Great. But if we really look at the top of our society, well, we've got white men going to the moon or into outer space because they're bored, then we're talking about much greater spoils that are being derived from racism and inequality at Amazon, for example. And so that's the problem with just limiting our scope to, I mean, if you think about it, and I'll just end on this, every radical began as a liberal, with the very rare exception of some red diaper baby somewhere. Most radicals begin as liberals. And if most of those people had just, you know, if we'd achieved some racial equality, then they would have stayed liberals. But the reason why people come to the conclusion that, wow, this is much bigger, we can't actually just cherry pick this or that thing with the system, is because they continue to run into the absolute intractability of the status quo. Now, of course, you can have some change, and there are some reforms, some of which are incredibly important, the civil rights movement and ending Jim Crow and securing the right to vote. But we can also see that those pressures to divide, to steal basic rights from people, always come back because the system is still intact. And so we thought we secured the right to vote in 1965 with the Voting Rights Act. And here we are fighting over Jim Crow-like ordinances to really keep Black people from being able to vote in the 21st century. And so that's the lesson. That's part of what radicalizes people, is the resilience of capitalism, that even when reforms are made, that there is a pressure to go back, to revert back to the old ways, that reforms come through massive pressure. And as soon as that massive pressure disappears, there's an immediate attempt to refill the vacuum with the reactionary old ways that we all just struggle to get rid of in the first place. And that's why people radicalize and come to the conclusion, not just me, but many people.
You've mentioned a couple of times that you don't think certain ideas are utopian. And so, you know, it seems that you push back against, you know, ideas that are labeled as utopian or unachievable. And I'm curious what liberation means to you and whether you believe Black liberation is possible in the United States.
So I actually thought a lot about this when I was writing the book. And for me, it really came down to self-determination. Can we make decisions free of economic coercion, right? Can we make decisions that are truly free? And that to me is what liberation would be. And I know that it's not something that Black people can achieve alone. I write about this, that Black liberation is bound up with human liberation on a purely mathematical basis. Black people are drift between 13% and 14% of the population, and we can't get free alone. And so this is also about really trying to examine the connections between the subjugation of Black people and how that relates to a wider web of subjugation of other people as well and in our society. And that includes white people too. It includes ordinary white people that I think, of course, is easy to overlook and to ignore, but that we have to take seriously when the life expectancy of ordinary white people has gone into decline because of alcoholism, suicide, and opioid addiction. It means that there's something wrong in this country for those people as well. And what is a politics that can understand that? And not in a way that subsumes the liberation of Black people to that, but sees these as united, as a part of the same problem. They are distinct, they are different, but they are a part of the same problem, which is a society that is organized around the profiteering of a small clique to the detriment of everyone else. You can't have billionaires flying in space without immense poverty and misery here on Earth, right? I mean, Amazon, why is Bezos so fabulously rich? Because he treats his workers like. And so that's a problem that unites many people. Now, the politics of actually being able to win, not just, you know, white people who have racist ideas, but Black people who have xenophobic ideas and racist ideas about other people. And this is what that competition over what we are told there is not enough of does. It sets people against each other. And that's part of the problem. And that's part of what has to be unlocked. Do I think Black liberation is possible in the United States? I do, not as the United States is currently configured. These are problems that we can't vote our way in or out of. These are not problems that are on the ballot, right? We don't get to vote on the massive redistribution of wealth and resources in this country. And so it really requires a different kind of society where there's the democratic input of all of us about what our society should be and what it should look like. And that can't happen in the way that this country exists now. And so to that extent, what I'm talking about is really a revolutionary transformation of the United States. Is it possible? I don't know if it's possible, but I don't know what else to do in terms of what I spend my time thinking about, talking about, writing about, and doing that with other people. It might not work. You know, I don't know. It might not work, but I know that this doesn't work. And this isn't intolerable. I mean, it's intolerable on many levels. And then there's like, the planet is on fire. There's the kind of liberal idea sometimes that things will just kind of, we have problems, but it'll just, you know, they'll just keep going on the way they are. But the way they are is not possible. And it feels even more unwieldy after last summer, after Trump. It feels like, no, the status quo cannot continue to hold. You have raving fascist white supremacists who are not, well, let's just bide our time, but who want to strip us of our right to vote, imprison us, and do God knows what else. So there's a little bit of existential urgency to kind of figure it out, but we got to figure it out. But I think most people that, you know, not most people, but a growing number of people, you know, I think recognize that the status quo as it currently exists is not working.
So the last two questions do you have any advice on reviving groups' momentum as actions and numbers wane? Mm-hmm. And then the other question is, I wonder what Kianga thinks about the strategy to create independent organizations and parties at the same time that we struggle within the Democratic Party and inside-outside strategy. So these seem somewhat related in that sometimes actions and numbers wane in part because momentum is not being sustained and begins to feel either futile or people get exhausted and worn out. But without a clear sense of what the inside-outside strategy is or whether one is even warranted, and without new independent organizations and parties, it can be difficult to sustain enthusiasm for kind of forever protests. So curious how you would respond to those questions.
So the first one I'm more familiar with, and meaning that it's more, to me, it's more straightforward, which is that the momentum around protest and actions it's like a human body, that it has a limit, and you can't just rely on that. With all movements, there are ebbs and flows. There are times of lots of activity. Some might describe it as hyperactivity that corresponds with, you know, a kind of, like we saw last summer, an awakening in the general population. And it's great to ride that wave, but that it is a wave, and you really to build sustained organizations over time, you have to understand that it's a wave. And then the question is, well, what do you do when the wave crashes or passes over you? And there are lots of things to do, you know, and it depends on what kind of organization it is that you're trying to build. There's so many political questions that exist right now. Is this a time to kind of recalibrate your expectations, but still hold public meetings that engage with some of these questions, that provide a space for people who have similar questions, like what should we be doing right now? But to do that with other people. So holding public meetings, is this a time to deepen our politics and our understanding of things that have happened in the world previously? So should we be having study groups? Should we be meeting with other people to think more deeply about some of these questions, reading books together, reading articles together, but always with the idea that the wave will come again, you know? And it might not be to the extent of 26 million people, you know, participating in protests, but locally, there are all sorts of smaller waves around different kinds of political actions and protest. And so how do you both relate to those that exist, but how do you also come together with some people to create the wave, right? And so sometimes you can't do that on the same scale, but in every locality across this country, there's police brutality. There are issues with the criminal justice system. There's issues with that have been created by the pandemic. around housing. We're on the precipice of an eviction crisis. There are all sorts of smaller local issues that local organizations can dive into to build campaigns around, while at the same time paying attention to your own ideas, the development of your ideas, and analysis about what is happening in the world. So I would have some combination of having public meetings, having study groups, and finding ways that you can build struggles on a local level with other people in other kinds of organizations. Also the basis for building coalition. The second, the inside outside, I mean, that's a question that I have. You know, for a long time, I would scoff quite loudly at the inside outside strategy. And to some extent, I still do, but I don't know what to do. I know, I'm working on a story now about India Walton and her surprise victory in Buffalo, New York. India Walton is a Democratic Socialist. The DSA endorsed the campaign. It's very exciting. And it's going to be really hard. It's going to be really hard because you have a city council there that she will have to co-govern with. That is hostile for the most part and made up of people who embody all the things that she ran against. And so she and the comrades that organized that campaign are going to have really powerful enemies very quickly from the start. And so how do you deal with that? Like what do you do in the face of tremendous pressure? Because the answer isn't, well, you shouldn't run, right? Because it will be hard to govern. But it raises, I think, new questions that the American left is starting to try to understand and deal with in a more serious way right now. Because you have pockets, you know, in Chicago, for example, there are, I think, 5 or 6 socialists who consider themselves a socialist caucus in the city council that have to deal with Lori Lightfoot, you know, on a daily basis. And should they not run because now they're a part of the establishment? No, of course they should be there. But then it's like, how do you network together? How do you be in touch with other elected officials who have a kind of common viewpoint so that you can learn lessons and generalize and have people to think with and strategize with? And then how do you, you know, what is the relationship between organizations and social movements who aren't in office, but who are now in the position of how do we pressure these people that we see as comrades in struggle who are now in positions of power? It's an important question that I think all too often there are some segments of the left that are just cavalier about it and kind of blow it off. But I think that these are serious dilemmas to try to wrap our hands around or our heads around and understand. So I don't know. I think it's a question that I'm trying to understand in real time.
You were just listening to Kianga Yamata Taylor on Black Liberation. She was interviewed in Philadelphia by Michelle Alexander in mid-July. Kianga Yamata Taylor writes and speaks on Black politics, social movements, and racial inequality. She's a professor of African American Studies at Princeton and the author of the award-winning book From Hashtag Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and in our 36th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs of today's program, Kianga Yamata Taylor on Black Liberation, and for her book, From Hashtag Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation, just give us a call at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. We're offering printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program at no charge. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Haymarket Books. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Nina Simone singing Langston Hughes's Backlash Blues.
Mr. Backlash, Mr. Backlash, just who do you think I am? You raise my taxes, freeze my wages, and send my son to Vietnam. You give me second-class houses and second-class schools. Do you think that all colored folks are just second-class fools? Mr. Backlash, I'm gonna leave you with a backlash blues. When I try to find a job to earn a little cash, all you got to offer is your mean old white backlash. But the world is big, big and bright and round, and it's full of folks like me who are black, yellow, beige, and brown. Mr. Backlash, I'm gonna leave you with a backlash blue.
RCT, Pittsburgh.
Saul, Commissioner of Social Security. Beware of telephone scammers pretending to be government employees. Real Social Security employees will never threaten you. call is threatening you with arrest or other legal action and demanding money are not from us. If you receive a call like this, hang up, do not provide them with any form of payment or information, report the call at oig.ssa.gov.
That is certainly a nice way to start off this show, which is all about sex today. It is the human experience winding down with a four-part series. This is part two, sex, and this winds down with the four best things in life. Last week, we did all the dance crazes, dancing, kind of a precursor to sex. This week is sex. Next week is going to be all songs about drinking. So another good thing about life. And then we're going to do eating. And it just happens to fall on the day after the Thanksgiving. And I got a special Thanksgiving Day feast for you. So that is going to be coming up the 26th. And then the quarterly reports start in December. Then I go back in the studio live after the first